You're listening to a day of special programming in celebration of International Women's Day on KPFA. I'm Julia Hutton. In the next hour, This Bridge Called My Back, writings by radical women of color.
I've had enough. I'm sick of seeing and touching both sides of things, sick of being the damn bridge for everybody. Nobody can talk to anybody without me, right? I explain my mother to my father to my little sister to my brother to the white feminists to the black church folks to the ex-hippies to the black separatists to the artists to my friends' parents. Then I've got to explain myself to everybody. I do more translating than the goddamn UN. Forget it. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of filling your gaps, sick of being your insurance against the isolation of your self-imposed limitations, sick of being the crazy at your holiday dinners, sick of being the odd one at your Sunday brunches, sick of being the sole black friend of 34 individual white people. Find another connection to the rest of the world. Find something else to make you legitimate. Find some other way to be political and hip. I will not be the bridge to your womanhood, your manhood, your humanness. I'm sick of reminding you not to close off too tight for too long. I'm sick of mediating with your worst self on behalf of your better selves. I'm sick of having to remind you to breathe before you suffocate your own full self. Forget it. Stretch or drown, evolve or die. The bridge I must be is the bridge to my own power. I must translate my own fears, mediate my own weaknesses. I must be the bridge to nowhere but to my true self, and then I will be useful.
The Bridge Poem by Donna Kate Russian. It's the title work in the groundbreaking anthology, This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color. 29 women contributed poems, essays, analysis, and personal narratives. Feminists, each considers her experience and identity in light of the barriers of race, class, culture, color, gender, and sexual identity. They name the damage. And they affirm the authority of the individual story, the shared story, and the power to transform experience. I'm Julia Hutton. In the next hour, we'll hear writers read from the poems, essays, and personal narratives they contributed to this remarkable anthology. I recorded most of these readings in a studio setting shortly after the book was first published. Some readings took place at public venues. The interviews and readings you'll hear helped generate a wave of excitement, theory, and conversation. Word of mouth and feminist bookstores helped sell about 20,000 copies in the book's first year. What began as a bold experiment has proven visionary and lasting. Today, This Bridge Called My Back is considered one of the cornerstones of third-wave feminism and intersectionality. It's widely read, part of many college courses, and now in its fourth printing. Capturing a moment, giving language to contradictory, little-explored aspects of identity, its insights and observations are still fresh and timely. The idea for the book began with its co-editors, Gloria Anzaldúa and Cherie Moraga. I interviewed Cherie Moraga soon after the book came out, in a San Francisco apartment, chilly as I remember, with traffic rumbling by. Cherie told me that originally she had not wanted to take on the project. But several months later, she realized she was afraid.
When I'm really afraid of doing something, that usually is an indication to me that there's something there for me to find out. And the thing I was mostly afraid of is that how it would change me, you know, because I felt like there was many ways in which I was even very afraid of really dealing with how much being Chicana meant to me. I really didn't want to deal. I wanted to, and then I didn't want to because I felt like it would really have ramifications that I would not necessarily have could predict, you know. And in fact, that's true, you know. It's sort of like, you know, bring the subject up and then you are even a greater victim to whatever kind of racism people have in them or whatever. But not only that, just like also just having to sort of deal with the ways in which too I, you know, had colluded in my own silence and colluded in my own assimilation. And those are really painful things to look at. So on a very deeply personal level, I didn't want to have to deal. So I did, you know, because there was something there I needed to find out. What I really didn't want was the book to just be rhetorical, you know, say racism, sexism, classism every 5 minutes and it doesn't mean anything, but to say, so what happened to you? And also trying to validate that, you know, we can make theory out of our lives. Any person who does theory is really like, they're really trying to get theory to justify their experience, but they're not copying to that. And I think that what women of color do, as I think exemplified in Bridge, is put their experience out and say, therefore, I think this. This happened because of this, and this happened to my friend, and therefore, I'm drawing these conclusions. So I feel it's much more honest.
Nellie Wong, When I Was Growing Up.
I know now that once I longed to be white. How, you ask? Let me tell you the ways. When I was growing up, people told me I was dark, and I believed my own darkness in the mirror, in my soul, my own narrow vision. When I was growing up, my sisters with fair skin got praised for their beauty, and in the dark, I fell further, crushed between high walls. When I was growing up, I read magazines and saw movies, blonde movie stars, white skin, sensuous lips, and to be elevated, to become a woman, a desirable woman, I began to wear imaginary pale skin. When I was growing up, I was proud of my English, my grammar, my spelling, fitting into the group of smart children, smart Chinese children, fitting in, belonging, getting in line. When I was growing up and went to high school, I discovered the rich white girls, a few yellow girls, their imported cotton dresses, their cashmere sweaters, their curly hair, and I thought that I too should have what these lucky girls had. When I was growing up, I hungered for American food, American styles, coated white, and even to me, a child born of Chinese parents, being Chinese was feeling foreign, was limiting, was un-American. When I was growing up and a white man wanted to take me out, I thought I was special, an exotic gardenia, anxious to fit the stereotype of an Oriental chick. When I was growing up, I felt ashamed of some yellow men, their small bones, their frail bodies. They're spitting on the streets. They're coughing. They're lying in sunless rooms, shooting themselves in the arms. When I was growing up, people would ask if I were Filipino, Polynesian, Portuguese. They named all colors except white, the shell of my soul, but not my dark, rough skin. When I was growing up, I felt dirty. I thought that God made white people clean, and no matter how much I bathed, I could not change. I could not shed my skin in the gray water. When I was growing up, I swore I would run away to purple mountains, houses by the sea, with nothing over my head, with space to breathe, uncongested with yellow people, in an area called Chinatown, in an area I later learned was a ghetto, one of many hearts of Asian America. I know now that once I longed to be white. How many more ways, you ask? Haven't I told you enough?
Barbara Cameron, reading from her essay, Gee, You Don't Seem Like an Indian from the Reservation.
One of the very first words I learned in my Lakota language was Weshichu, which designates white people. At that early age, my comprehension of Weshichu was gained from observing and listening to my family discussing the Weshichu. My grandmother always referred to white people as the Weshichu Shicha, with emphasis on Shicha, our word for terrible or bad. By the age of 5, I had seen one Indian man gunned down in the back by the police and was a silent witness to a gang of white teenage boys beating up an elderly Indian man. I'd hear stories of Indian ranch hands being accidentally shot by white ranchers. I quickly began to understand the Weshichu menace my family spoke of. My hatred for the Weshichu was solidly implanted by the time I entered first grade. Unfortunately, in first grade, I became teacher's pet, so my teacher had a fondness for hugging me, which always repulsed me. I couldn't stand the idea of a white person touching me. Eventually, I realized that it wasn't the white skin that I hated, but it was their culture of deceit, greed, racism, and violence. During my first memorable visit to a white town, I was appalled that they thought of themselves as superior to my people. Their manner of living appeared devoid of life and bordered on hostility even for one another. They were separated from each other by their perfectly, politely fenced square plots of green lawn. The only lawns on my reservation were the lawns of the BIA officials or white Christians. The white people always seemed so loud, obnoxious, and vulgar, and the white parents were either screaming at their kids, threatening them with some form of punishment, or hitting them. After spending a day around white people, I was always happy to go back to the reservation, where people followed a relaxed yet respectful code of relating with each other. The easy teasing and joking that were inherent with the Lakota was a welcome relief after a day with the plastic faces. I vividly remember two occasions during my childhood in which I was cognizant of being an Indian. The first time was at about 3 years of age when my family took me to my first powwow. I kept asking my grandmother Where are the Indians? Where are the Indians? I was very curious and strangely excited about the prospect of seeing real live Indians, even though I myself was one. It's a memory that has remained with me through all these years because it's so full of the subtleties of my culture. There was a sweet, wonderful aroma in the air from the dancers and the traditional food booths. There were lots of grandmothers and grandfathers with young children running about. Powwows in the plains usually last for 3 days, sometimes longer, with Indian people traveling from all parts of our country to dance, to share food and laughter, and to be with each other. I could sense the importance of our gathering times, and it was the beginning of my awareness that my people are of a great and different nation. The second time in my childhood, when I knew very clearly that I am an Indian, occurred when I was attending an all-white elementary school. During Halloween, my friends and I went trick-or-treating. At one of the last stops, the mother knew all of the children except for me. She asked me to remove my mask so she could see who I was. After I removed my mask, she realized I was an Indian and quite cruelly told me so, refusing to give me the treats my friends had received. It was a stingingly painful experience. I told my mother about it the next evening after I tried to understand it. My mother was outraged and explained the realities of being an Indian in South Dakota. My mother paid a visit to the woman, which resulted in their expressing a barrage of equal hatred for one another. I remember sitting in our pickup, hearing the intensity of the anger and feeling very sad that my mother had to defend her child to someone who wasn't worthy of her presence. I spent a part of my childhood feeling great sadness and helplessness about how it seemed that Indians were open game for the white people to kill, maim, beat up, insult, rape, cheat, or whatever atrocity the white people wanted to play with. There was also a rage and frustration that has not died. When I look back on reservation life, it seems that I spent a great deal of time attending the funerals of my relatives or friends of my family. During 1 year, I went to funerals of 4 murder victims. Most of my non-Indian friends have not seen a dead body or have not been to a funeral. Death was so common on the reservation that I did not understand the implications of the high death rate until after I moved away and was surprised to learn that I've seen more dead bodies than my friends will probably ever see in their lifetime. Because of experiencing racial violence, I sometimes panic when I'm the only non-white in a room full of whites, even if they are my closest friends. I wonder if I'll leave the room alive. The seemingly copacetic gay world of San Francisco becomes a mere dream after the panic leaves. I think to myself that it's truly insane for me to feel the panic. I want to scream out my anger and disgust with myself for feeling distrustful of my white friends, and I want to banish the society that has fostered these feelings of alienation. I wonder at the amount of assimilation which has affected me and how long my Indianness will allow me to remain in a city that is far removed from the lives of many Native Americans.
Aurora Levens Morales, and even Fidel can't change that.
The point of terror, the point of denial, the point of hatred is the tight dress stretched across my grandmother's big breasts, the coquettish, well-made-up smile, grandmother, aunt, and great-aunts all decked out in sex, talking about how I'm pretty, talking about how men are only good for one thing, hating sex and gloating over the hidden filthiness in everything. And yet, I tell you, I love those women for facing up to the ugliness there. No romance, no roses and moonlight and pure love. You say pure love to one of these women and they snort and ask you what the man has between his legs and is it pure? I love these women for the sessions that pool common knowledge and tell the young wife, oh yes, the first time he cheated on me, I tried that too, but he just beat me. Listen, don't give him the satisfaction. The next time. These women don't believe in the sanctity of the marriage bond, the inviolable privacy of the husband-wife unit. The cattiness is mixed with information, tips. The misery is communal. Claustrophobia, a reality I can't make a dent in because it's the misery that's communal. The resistance is individual and frowned upon. It rocks the boat. How many times has a Latin woman stood up for me in private, then stabbed me in the back when the moment comes for support that counts? How many times has a Latin woman used me to and then gone running to men for approval, leaving me in the lurch? The anger is real and deep. You have forced me to turn out of my own culture to find allies worthy of the name. You have forced me into a room full of Anglo women who nod sympathetically and say, Latin men are so much worse than Anglo men. Why, the last time I was in Mexico, you couldn't walk down the street without some guy. It must be so hard for you to be a Latin feminist. And not to betray you in the face of their racism, I betray myself and in the end you by not saying, it's not the men who exile me, it's the women. I don't trust the women. Points of terror, points of denial. Repeat the story that it was my grandmother who went to look at apartments. Light-skinned, fine black hair. I'm Italian, she would tell them, keeping the dark-skinned husband, keeping the daughters out of sight. I have pretended that pain, that shame, that anger never touched me, does not stain my skin. She could pass for Italian. She kept her family behind her. I can pass for anyone. Behind me stands my grandmother working at the bra and girdle factory, speaking with an accent, lying to get an apartment in Puerto Rican-less neighborhoods. Piri Thomas's book, Down These Mean Streets, followed me around for years in the corner of my eye on bus terminal book racks. Finally, in a gritted-teeth desperation, I faced the damn thing and said, okay, tell me. I sweated my way through it in two nights. Gang fights, knifings, robbery, smack, prison. It's the standard Puerto Rican street story, except he lived. The junkies could be my younger brothers, the prisoners could be them. I could be the prostitute, the welfare mother, the sister and lover of junkies, the child of alcoholics. There is nothing but circumstance and good English, nothing but my mother marrying into the middle class between me and that life. The image stays with me of my mother's family fleeing their Puerto Ricanness, the first on the block, behind them the neighborhoods collapsing into slums. There was a war, she told me. The enemy was only a step behind. I borrow the pictures from my other family, the nightmares of my Jewish ancestry, and imagine them fleeing through the streets. My mother never went back to look. This year she saw on television the ruins of the Tiffany Street of her childhood, unrecognizable, bombarded by poverty and urban renewal into an image of some European city, 1945. Like the Jews, like many people, the place she could have returned to has been destroyed. I saw a baby once, the same age as my fat, crowing baby brother, then 6 months old. I was 12, and under the influence of our Seventh-day Adventist teacher, some of the girls in the seventh grade took up a collection for two poor families in the neighborhood. We bought them each one bag of groceries. This baby was just a little bit of skin stretched over a tiny skeleton. It hardly moved. It didn't even cry. It just lay there. The woman's husband had left her, and the oldest boy, he was 13 or 14, worked picking coffee to help out. When we came, the younger kids hid in their mother's skirts, and she just stood there crying and crying. I ran straight home from that place, and the first thing I did was to find my brother and hug him very tightly, and then I spent the rest of the afternoon feeding him. If something had happened to my father, the ghost over my mother's shoulder would have caught us up. Papi was our middle-class passport. I grew up a professor's daughter, on the road to college, speaking good English. I can pass for anyone. Behind me stands my grandmother. Behind me lie the mean streets. Behind me, my little brother, is nothing but skin and skeleton. Sitting in a kitchen in oh-so-white New Hampshire with old friends, mother and daughter, Cece says, it takes three generations. If you resolve your relationship with your mother, you'll both change, and your daughter will have it easier. But her daughter will be raised differently. In the third generation, the daughters are free. I'm not thinking then of this essay, but days later when I sit down again to work, the phrase keeps ringing, in the third generation, the daughters are free. Don't you think I've swallowed my mouths full of blood? It's different for a man. You're too stubborn. You've always wanted your own way. It was this way for my grandmother. It was this way for my mother. It was this way for me because this is the way it is. God made men and women different, and even Fidel can't change that. Anything is better than being alone. Older Women in Portrait of Teresa, Cuban film, 1979. My mother and I work to unravel the knot. The task is daily, bloody, terrifying, and necessary, and filled with joy. The relationship between mother and daughter stands at the center of what I fear most in our culture. Heal that wound and we change the world. A revolution capable of healing our wounds. If we're the ones who can imagine it, if we're the ones who dream about it, if we're the ones who need it most, then no one else can do it. We're the ones.
You're listening to This Bridge Called My Back, writings by radical women of color, poems, essays, and personal narratives in the voices of the women who wrote them. It's special programming for International Women's Day on KPFA. Merle Wu, Letter to Ma.
Dear Ma, I was depressed over Christmas, and when New Year's rolled around, do you know what one of my resolves was? Not to come by and see you as much anymore. I had to ask myself why I get so down when I'm with you, my mother, who has focused so much of her life on me, who has endured so much, one who I am proud of and respect so deeply for simply surviving. I suppose that one of the main reasons is that when I leave your house, your pretty little round white table in the dinette where we sit while you drink tea with only 3 specks of jasmine, and I smoke and drink coffee, I am down because I believe there are chasms between us. When you say, I support you, honey, in everything you do, except, I know you mean except my speaking out and writing of my anger at all those things that have caused those chasms between us. When you say I shouldn't be so ashamed of Daddy, former gambler, retired clerk of a guksui store, because of the time when I was 6 and saw him humiliated on Grant Avenue by 2 white cops, I know you haven't even been listening to me when I have repeatedly said that I am not ashamed of him, not you, not who we are. When you ask, are you so angry because you are unhappy? I know that we are not talking to each other. Not with understanding, although many words have passed between us, many hours, many afternoons at that round table, with Daddy out in the front room watching television and drifting out every once in a while to say, still talking? And getting more peanuts that are so bad for his health. We talk, and I feel frustrated by your censorship. I know it is unintentional and unconscious, but whatever I have told you about the classes I was teaching or the stories I was working on, you've always forgotten within a month. Do you see your repressed anger manifested in me? What doors would groan wide open if you heard my words with complete understanding? When I look at you, there are images. Images of you as a little 10-year-old Korean girl being sent alone from Shanghai to the United States in steerage with only 1 skimpy little dress. Being sick and lonely on Angel Island for 3 months, then growing up in a home run by white missionary women. Scrubbing floors on your hands and knees, hauling coal in heavy metal buckets up 3 flights of stairs, tending to the younger children, putting hot bricks on your cheeks to deaden the pain from the terrible toothaches you always had. Working all your life as maid, waitress, sales clerk, office worker, mother. But throughout there is an image of you as strong and courageous and persevering. Climbing out of windows to escape from the home, then later from an abusive first husband. There is so much more to these images than I can say, but I think you know what I mean. Escaping out of windows offered only temporary respites. Surviving is an everyday chore. You gave me physically what you never had, but there was a spiritual, emotional legacy you passed down, which was reinforced by society. Self-contempt because of our race, our sex, our sexuality. For deeply ingrained in me, Ma, there has been that strong compulsive force to sink into self-contempt, passivity, and despair. I am sure that my 15 years of alcohol abuse have not been forgotten by either of us, nor my suicidal depressions. Now, I know you are going to think that I hate and despise you for your self-hatred, for your isolation, but I don't, because in spite of your withdrawal, in spite of your loneliness, you have not only survived, but been beside me in the worst of times, when your company meant everything in the world to me. I just need more than that now, Ma. I have taken and taken from you in terms of needing you to mother me, to be by my side, and I need now to take from you two more things: understanding and support for who I am now and my work. We are Asian American women, and the reaction to our identity is what causes the chasms instead of connections. But do you realize, Ma, that I could never have reacted the way I have if you had not provided for me the opportunity to be free of the binds that have held you down and to be in the process of self-affirmation? Because of your life, because of the physical security you have given me, my education, my full stomach, my clothed and starched back, my piano and dancing lessons, all those gifts you never received, I saw myself as having worth. Now I begin to love myself more, see our potential, and fight for just that kind of social change that will affirm me, my race, my sex, my heritage. And while I affirm myself, Ma, I affirm you. Today I am satisfied to call myself either an Asian American feminist or yellow feminist. The two terms are inseparable because race and sex are an integral part of me. This means that I am working with others to realize pride in culture and women and heritage, the heritage that is the exploited yellow immigrant, Daddy, and you. Being a yellow feminist means being a community activist and a humanist. It does not mean separatism, either by cutting myself off from non-Asians or men. It does not mean retaining the same power structure and substituting women in positions of control held by men. It does mean fighting the whites and the men who abuse us, straitjacket us, and tape our mouths. It means changing the economic class system and psychological forces, sexism, racism, and homophobia, that really hurt all of us. And I do this not in isolation, but in the community. Yellow feminist means being a core for change, and that core means having the belief in our potential as human beings.
Barbara Smith and Beverly Smith, reading their essay, Across the Kitchen Table, A Sister-to-Sister Dialogue, recorded at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley.
There's nothing to compare with how you feel when you're cut cold by your own. I think the reason that black women are so homophobic is that attraction-repulsion thing. They have to speak out vociferously against lesbianism because if they don't, they may have to deal with their own deep feelings for women. Is homophobia more entrenched in the black community than in the white community?
You can argue that until Jesus comes, really, honey.
Yes. I really think that historically, politically, there are more reasons for the black community to be homophobic. One of them being that the women's movement has made fewer inroads into the black community, as well as the gay rights movement. We can think that a community that has been subject to the ideas of the movement is going to have more consciousness. And given how, up until just the last few years, the feminist movement has not touched third world communities, we can expect their attitudes to be much as they have been in the past.
One of the reasons that I have thought for homophobic attitudes among black women is the whole sexual stereotyping used against all black people anyway, but especially women in relation to homosexuality. You know, the black bulldogger image. Lesbianism is definitely about something sexual, a so-called deviant sexuality. So the way most black women deal with it is to be just as rigid and closed about it as possible. White people don't have a sexual image that another oppressor community has put on them.
Yeah, that's right. This country is so racist that it is possible to take many, many things and concepts that have nothing to do with race and talk about them in racial terms. Because people are so divided into either black or white, it defines a continuum. This is so strict and so overwhelming in this country, you can take things that have nothing to do with race and refer to them racially.
Therefore, black people have the option of taking things, sexual behavior, conflicts, whatever they don't like, and saying, that's white. Lesbianism is not the only thing seen as a white thing. A real good example is suicide. Black people say, yeah, suicide is a white thing.
Oh, yeah, we used to believe that. And, of course, one felt all the worse for having considered it. I'm thinking of Ntozake Shange's play for colored girls who consider suicide. It's very brave. I mean, she's dealing with a lot of myths by saying that we have even considered it, if it's supposed to be a white thing.
Surely. Any behavior black people say is despicable, they can disregard by saying this doesn't belong to the black community. There's hardly a thing in our experience that is not referred to being either black or white. From animals on, people talking about white dogs. They weren't talking about dogs that were white in color. They were talking about dogs that belong to white people.
So often, lesbianism and male homosexuality is talked about as a white disease within the black community. It is just so negating of our lives, very upsetting.
Are black women really more vulnerable to homophobic attack?
Yes, black women are more vulnerable to homophobic attack because we don't have white skin privilege or class privilege to fall back on. If somebody wants to start a smear campaign against us, and I know you know this, as I said in my essay toward a black feminist criticism,
tell me about it,
is always the last to go. We don't have any of the other privileges. It really is jumping off the edge in a very fundamental way. Somebody who is already dealing with multiple oppression is more vulnerable to another kind of attack upon their identity.
Yeah, I also feel that black women are more vulnerable to physical attack as lesbians because they're black. The stories you hear over the years of black lesbians being attacked for being lesbian, usually by white men. But what is the relationship between black women's resistance to identifying as feminist and lesbian?
It's real connected. Feminists have been portrayed as nothing but lesbians to the black community as well. Mm-hmm. There was a considerable effort in the early 70s to turn the black community off to feminism. You can look at publications, particularly black publications like Ebony and Jet, making pronouncements about what the feminist movement was and who it reached that would trivialize it, that would say no black women were involved, that did everything possible to prevent those coalitions between black and white women from happening because there was a great deal of fear. Black men did not want to lose black women as allies, and the white power structure did not want to see all women bond across racial lines because they knew that would be an unbeatable, unstoppable combination. They did a very good job. You can just document those things happening during that period.
So yes, most black women think that to be a feminist, you have to be a lesbian. And if not that, then at least you have to deal with being around lesbians. As you see, that is true. It's very hard. It's very hard.
hard to be in the women's movement and not be around lesbians. And if you're so homophobic that you can't deal with the thought of lesbianism, then you probably won't be involved. I think these things are changing. More and more black women are becoming sensitive or sympathetic to the women's movement.
Don't you think it's about time?
Relieved.
Judith Moskowitz, But I Know You, American Woman.
I am Latina, Jewish, and an immigrant, all at once. When I tell people who I am, I usually see a puzzled look on their face. I'm likely to tell them, I realize that you're a little confused by me. How can I be both Jewish and Latin American at the same time? But just take my word for it. It is possible. You don't know me, but I know you, American women. I believe that lack of knowledge about other cultures is one of the bases for cultural oppression. I don't hold any individual American woman responsible for the roots of this ignorance about other cultures. It's encouraged and supported by the American educational and political system and by the American media. I do hold every woman responsible for the transformation of this ignorance. Anyone that was raised and educated in this country has a very good chance of being ignorant about other cultures, whether they be minority cultures in this country or those of other countries. It's a sort of cultural isolationism, a way of life enforced on the people in this country so as to let them have a free conscience with respect to how they deal with the rest of the world or with subcultures in America. Notice the lack of emphasis on learning other languages, and the lack of knowledge even about where other countries are located. Often, I am asked questions like, is Argentina in Europe or Africa? Or, don't you speak Portuguese down there? How can one feel guilt about screwing over someone, some country she knows nothing about? Think of it in terms of men's and women's cultures. Women live in male systems, no male rules, speak male language when around men, etc. But what do men really know about women? Only screwed-up myths concocted to perpetuate the power imbalance. It's the same situation when it comes to dominant and non-dominant, or colonizing and colonized cultures, countries, or people. As a bilingual, bicultural woman whose native culture is not American, I live in an American system, abide by American rules of conduct, speak English when around English speakers, etc., only to be confronted with utter ignorance or concocted myths and stereotypes about my own culture. My Latin culture means many things to me. The food I like to eat, the music I love, the books I read, the language I speak, the land and trees I remember in another country, the jokes I tell, how I'm used to kissing and hugging people when I greet them, etc., etc. I could go on forever. It also means the things I like to change in Latin culture. And I'm not speaking of changing men, but of changing systems of oppression. As a result of these changes, I don't foresee a culturalist vacuum because, quote, all cultures are bad, so I don't want any of them, unquote. That culturalist vacuum proposed would actually be the American culture of French fries and hamburgers, or soy burgers, American music on the radio, even if it's American women's music on a feminist radio show, not kissing and hugging every time you greet someone, etc. And it would ultimately still be the culture of exploitation of other countries and cultures combined with ignorance about them. I'm sick and tired of continually hearing only about the destructive aspects of Latin American culture, especially from women who don't know the culture and can only repeat well-known and worn-out myths. The unspoken question always seems to be, aren't Latin men more macho and women more oppressed in that culture? My answers to that are, One, it's absurd to compare sexist oppression. Oppression is oppression in whatever form or intensity. Two, sexist and heterosexist oppression is more or less visible depending on how communicative people in a culture are. That Anglo culture is more Puritan and less visibly expressive doesn't mean it is less sexist. Three, most of Latin America is a land economically colonized by the U.S., and as such, can't be compared with a colonizing culture, the U.S. Women's condition in Latin America would be much better were they not living in colonized countries. And four, most importantly, are we as feminists concerned with men or with women? There's always a women's culture within every culture. Why is everyone so willing to accept the very male view of Latin American culture as consisting simply of macho males and Catholic priests? There are scores of strong women living in Latin America today, and our history is full of famous and lesser-known strong women. Are they to be ignored as women have always been ignored? I've heard many people say, immigrants to this country should learn English, act American, and stop trying to keep their own culture. That's what I would do if I went to another country. I say bullshit. Culture isn't really something I have a choice in keeping or discarding. It's in me and of me. Without it, I would be an empty shell, and so would anyone else. Anglo people should realize when you say we should discard all cultures and start anew that you are speaking English, with all its emotional and conceptual advantages and disadvantages. You're not really about to change your taste in food, your basic style of relating to people, nor the way you talk. When Anglo-American women speak of developing a new feminist or women's culture, they're still working and thinking within an Anglo-American cultural framework. This new culture would still be just as racist and ethnocentric as patriarchal American culture. I would like us someday to get past the point of having to explain and defend our different cultures, as I'm doing in this letter. For that to happen, the process of learning about other cultures must be a sharing experience, an experience where American women learn on their own without wanting to be spoon-fed. But don't become experts after one book, one conversation, or one stereotype. It's a delicate balance which can only be achieved with caring and respect for each other.
Andrea Kanin, reading from her essay, Brownness.
I am brown, and I have experienced life as a brown person. Outwardly, I have traversed with ease the salons of the white rich, the bayous and lakes of Cajun South Louisiana, the hot white racism of Shreveport, the folksy backslapping peculiar institutions of Natchez, the friendly invisible oppression of Bay St. Louis and Ocean Springs, the humid, lazy apathy of New Orleans. With soul intact, identity sure, sense of humanness unchained by myth and ignorance, I have lived my years inside brown skin that didn't show the bruises, the wounds to anyone. Since before I can remember, brownness was always compared to whiteness in terms that were ultimately degrading for brownness. Lazy, shiftless, poor, non-human, dirty, abusive, ignorant, uncultured, uneducated, were used to convey conscious and unconscious messages that brown was not a good thing to be, and the ultimate model of things right and good was white. There was an all-powerful and real knowledge, like the pungent smell of chitlings cooking on a rainy winter day, that no matter how good, how clean, how pious the brown, they could not equal or reflect the ultimate good and right, white. By the time I was a woman, I had all the necessary external survival skills needed, supposedly, to protect me from the rejection and humiliation projected onto me by the white media, government, church, and social institutions. I had unending strength, ever-growing intellect, a heart as big as the heavens and the earth, a soul more forgiving than God's themselves, and I accepted total responsibility for myself, my own oppressed state, the impression of the brown man, the sin of being both brown and woman. This superwoman veneer protected me from the external world much of the time. This superwoman veneer also warded off the internal self-reflection needed to assess if indeed I was strong enough to carry such heavy burdens. The ever-growing intellect was an additional burden because the ability to think allows me to look at, if not truly see, options and truth. The open heart and the forgiving soul stifled my righteous indignation, gagged my rage, and forced my fears, my needs, my rage, my joys, my accomplishments inward. The acceptance of total responsibility, real, concrete, or abstract, for myself and others became my ultimate straitjacket, the last and the strongest barrier to self. The isolation is deafening and support is non-existent. The inherent conflicts of interests of parents, children, husbands, lovers, church, state, and self cry out like sound and fury, and we think ourselves crazed because there is a constant buzz in our ears. In this state, I began to see, as through a lifting mist, the enemies of self. I could see my enemy as my brownness, my community, my mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers. This is logical given my patterns of self-oppression. I could isolate myself from the brown community, claiming my right to be me without concern for our growth and development as a whole. I would, however, be cutting off an essential part of my development to nurture another. I would simply be acknowledging the oppression of my brownness and not that of my femaleness. They are both essential and important, however. The fact is, I am brown and female, and my growth and development are tied to the entire community. I must nurture and develop brown self, woman, man, and child. I must address the issues of my own oppression and survival. When I separate them, isolate them and ignore them. I separate, isolate, and ignore myself. I am a unit, a part of brownness. It would be very easy to identify white women as my enemy. As long as I do, however, I accept my devalued, oppressed, unliberated woman state. We do not trust her because she is white. We do not seek to know her because we would be betraying our brownness, collaborating with the enemy. Whiteness. We do not embrace her because she is woman. The problem here is that as we remain isolated and unknowing of woman, any woman, we continue to accept the basis for a part of our oppression. As we trade distrust and irresponsibility, we trade off our liberation. When we view liberation as a scarce resource, something only a precious few of us can have, we stifle our potential, our creativity, our genius for living, learning, and growing. It is hardest to see my enemy as brown men, yet in order to see myself clearly, I must face the closest threat to my survival, for it is he who rapes me, batters me, devalues my strength, will not allow my weakness. He is closest to me, for he is my father, my brother, my son, my man, my lover. I love him. I glory in his maleness and agonize in his degradation. I must refuse to allow him to oppress me while I must be concerned for his survival. This major conflict of interest is basic to brown oppression. Divide and conquer. Choose who is more worthy of liberation. I refuse to play this diabolical, self-destructive game. I refuse to play out the superwoman image as I refuse to believe the powerless, weak, politically ineffective attractive, super stud image of the brown man. We are both strong and weak, oppressed and oppressor of each, as well as by the super white culture. Our individual and collective development as men and women will not jeopardize, but enhance our liberation. The brown man is not my enemy, nor I his, but we must recognize that we both contribute to each other's oppression. To give to brown, white, men, women, etc., the status of all powerful is to cloak them in mystery and power. We must focus on those things within us that allow others to control us, know those who would empower themselves to control us, and understand that the powers can be brown, male or female, white male or female, as well as ourselves. We must demystify and know more in depth the world around us in order to distinguish friend from foe rather than accepting prefabricated enemies. When the bottom layer becomes a political force for itself, change will occur, and we are that bottom layer. Changes will not occur for that layer, but will move outward and upward throughout the society. Remember the civil rights movement? It has reverberated around the world to become a human rights movement. We are the bottom of the heap, brown women. We have the most to gain and the least to lose. Straight and lesbian among us, we must fight, learn, and grow with and for ourselves, our mothers, our daughters, and sisters across this nation. The buck stops here, as it did with a brown woman in Montgomery, Alabama. The women's movement is ours.
You've been listening to This Bridge Called My Back, writings by radical women of color. This program was produced by Julia Hutton. Original percussion was performed by Joy Gamble and Juana Lemus. Stay tuned for more special programming in celebration of International Women's Day on KPFA.